You've heard a number of them, politicians who say, well, I'm really personally opposed to a particular law, but I'm going to have to permit it because I don't want to foist my religious beliefs on others. Where is the line drawn when such a position becomes hypocritical, to say the least? That's what we're going to be talking about here on Law and Gospel on AM 850 KFUO this Thursday, October the 11th, 2007. Now, as many of you know, this is a call-in program, so you can call me to talk about this issue at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Tom Baker, your host on Inspirational Christian Radio for this hour. And I was a little prescient, I guess that's the word you use, because I set this up yesterday, got the St. Louis Post-Dispatch this morning. I hardly ever read it. I usually have my wife read it and then give me sections she thinks I'm interested in. And lo and behold, I just so happened to be glancing through it. And on B9, guess what? There's an article by Colleen Carol Campbell about this very subject. It's deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would say. In the 2008 presidential race, as in 2004, a leading Catholic candidate is struggling to reconcile his staunch support for legalized abortion with Catholic teaching that abortion is a grave moral evil. And St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke is facing intense scrutiny for saying that such a candidate should not receive communion. The 2004 candidate was Democratic Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, whose clumsy attempts to square altar boy anecdotes with his 100% voting score from the National Abortion Rights Action League helped him lose the Catholic vote to President Bush. When Burke said Kerry should not present himself for communion, critics accused Burke of partisan motivations. That criticism was debunked last week when Burke said he would apply the same principle to Republican Rudy Giuliani, who hopes to become his party's first pro-choice nominee in 32 years. Now, is it appropriate for anybody to want to pass a law that they are personally opposed to? Now, that's the question that we have before us this day. And it's not as easy to answer as one would think. And I'll tell you why. On the one hand, there's a lot of laws that are religious in nature that we would not want to impose upon certain people. What am I thinking of? Well, let's take the divorce laws. As a practicing pastor, I found out that at times you could excommunicate people even though they were not breaking any civil law or state law. For example, let's take two teenagers living together apart from marriage. At least at this point in this country, that is not breaking a law where you will get a fine or be put into jail if you're of legal age. Let's not even say teenagers, let's say two 30-year-olds. They begin to live together. Or, right now in St. Louis County, they're attempting to adopt an ordinance where landlords will not be able to say no to homosexuals in renting to them a home. Now, that same homosexual could be excommunicated from the church. This is an interesting situation. Should you make a law that landlords have the right to say no to certain people? In fact, they do have the right to say no to certain practices. For example, if you're a landlord with an apartment building, you can say no that you will not rent to people who smoke. Now, in that case, almost the entire apartment building has to be a no-smoking zone. You can't just pick and choose which people you're going to say no to that. Or you can say, no, I'm not going to rent to people who have children. It's not a sin to have children, but you can still have that as part of your rental policy, that you're only going to be renting to senior citizens or people without children. So, on the one hand, if I was a Christian politician, which I'm not, I could see a passing a law indicating that people have the right not to rent to people who have children, even though there's nothing in the Bible against that. See, I'm kind of reversing the situation. I'm taking something that I wouldn't oppose and yet allow it to be opposed for the sake of order. For example, if you're a senior citizen and you're retiring and the particular apartments are set up for senior citizens, there's no place for children to play, and it might even be dangerous with certain elevators or escalators to have children in the building that are unescorted, then I could see making a rule that this is set aside for senior citizens. And I personally don't see any problem in anybody doing that. So there would be an example where I'm not against having children in an apartment building, but I would adopt a law for the sake of order that in certain circumstances, landlords could permit to have that refused on their lease, that you cannot have children, or even pets. There are people who are allergic to dogs or to cats, and if you have an allergic-free zone, you'd be able to do something like that. So here you would be pushing a law, supporting a law that you yourself are not particularly opposed to in the sense of having, say, cats or dogs, but for the sake of order. Now we're doing the reverse. There's no doubt in some situations that the church will take a stand that we don't want to impose on secular society, and the one I have in mind is divorce. If there's a couple in my congregation who are both members of the congregation and they have an unbiblical divorce, then we would excommunicate them, even though the laws of the land permit them to have such a divorce. Now, under what kind of circumstances would that take place? Well, let's say they're both married, but they decide that they love somebody else, and so the only reason they're having a divorce is because they no longer love one another and they want to go with their new boyfriend or their new girlfriend. That would be inappropriate, and it would be called an unbiblical divorce. But in states such as No Fault, Missouri, they would be able to be granted a divorce by the government. Now, the question is, if I were a politician, would I be able to vote for such a divorce law, allowing people to have a divorce on grounds that are outside of the Bible? We do have that Bible verse from Jesus that from the beginning it was not so, but for the hardness of your heart, God permitted divorce. And we just need to recognize that Christian ethics are not necessarily to be imposed upon the government unless they lead to even more disorder. Now, it would seem to me abortion is a good case in point. If a person is of a religious persuasion that is against abortion, then I don't really see how he could take a stand pro-abortion. Because here we're not dealing with some practice or for the hardness of their heart. We're really dealing with a situation where we're allowing murder to take place. Because that's what happens in an abortion, an elective abortion, where you put to death the child in the womb. Or in a partial birth of abortion, after the child is out of the womb, at least the head. So what we're speaking of here now is something far greater than various practices or traditions that may or may not be appropriate for a government to be holding to. And it seems to me that if you take a strong stand, for example, let's just take one from World War II, that you're a member of the Nazi Party and you discover that their policy is that Jews are subhuman. Now, can you stand there and say, well, personally, I don't agree with that, but I don't want to impose my religious belief on the country? No, the Nuremberg trials made very clear that that was not a valid excuse. And even under orders to kill Jews and others in gas concentration camps was inappropriate. In fact, gypsies and homosexuals were also gathered up, as well as Jews. Now, it is not a sin to be a Jew. It is not a sin to be a gypsy. It is a sin to practice homosexuality. But I definitely, as a legislator, would say it is inappropriate to put homosexuals to death for their action of homosexuality, such as the Nazis were doing. I would take a stand on that, and just because it was the laws of the land, it doesn't give me the right to do that. We need to understand that because there is a law in the land doesn't mean it's the will of God for you. So we have laws in the land, no-fault divorce. But that cannot be a will of God for a Christian. There's only two grounds for divorce that are permitted in the Bible: adultery and desertion. And outside of those, you'd have to be very careful in not bringing discipline on the individual initiating the divorce for that particular reason. On the other hand, there can be areas where religious life says that this is really important for the point of view of the whole planet, that we would therefore stand fast. And certain things would be, in this day and age, abortion, and I also believe homosexual marriage. This would be a destroying of the family, as is known in a culture. And so I do not understand how a Christian could hold fast that homosexuals should not be married and yet support a law to do that when you're really going to be causing even more problems in the fabric of society. There's going to be a breakdown in society unless a Sodom and Gomorrah thing happens. And what do I mean by that? The sins of Sodom and Gomorrah were of such a nature that God therefore withheld the normal consequences of sin, so that people began to think that they can now do what they once thought was wrong, and they stopped doing what they thought was right. Everything was reversed. And so the normal consequences of sin, this is the worst wrath that God can place on a person or on a nation, on a city, is you take away the normal consequences of sin. And that's what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah. And of course, you know what happened to them is fire came down from heaven and destroyed those two cities because of their horrible unbelief leading to the kinds of sins that they were doing. Now, where God draws the line, I have no idea. Whether he does it still with individuals or nations, that's something that's hard to figure out. Although it is not unusual to find somebody who may be an agnostic, an atheist, or a non-Christian who thinks he's having the time of his life. And whether he's lying or not, that's something you can't read his heart. But everything seems to go swimmingly in his life. He's making a lot of money, seems to have a pretty good family, there's unity at work, and he's well-respected in the community, even though he is not a believer in Jesus Christ. Now, is that because God has placed a tremendous curse upon him? Or is it because something is coming down the line that God hopes to use to bring that person to a spiritual understanding of the importance of Jesus Christ? The line to be drawn, therefore, is when the state need not implement a particular position of the Christian church. And there are hundreds of areas where states ought not do that. For example, we do not believe that sinning is only by doing something wrong. We also think that sinning is by saying something wrong or even thinking something wrong. Now, can you imagine if there were laws against thinking? You come up to a stop sign, you stop, you look both ways, and then you go through and you're pulled over by a policeman. You say, why am I being pulled over? He says, because of the stop sign. But I came to a full stop. Yeah, but you were thinking about going through. Oh, well, yeah, how'd you know that? Well, I just took a guess. And so here's the fine for thinking. Now, isn't it clear that you don't impose Christian ethics on a society in the area of thinking? And it appears that it is also true in the area of verbiage. There are occasions when somebody who curses and swears in days gone by could be arrested, but today, I think that's a rare situation at all. How many times do you watch a program like Cops that has a video camera viewing a real situation of a policeman pulling someone over, and the person who's pulled over starts swearing at the policeman, and the policeman calmly just writes out the ticket and hands it to the person, and then the person takes off and the policeman goes back to his car. No ticket for swearing or cursing. But if you did that within a church and were unrepentant of it, then discipline would be necessary. So I think we're at a point where we know that the church cannot just insist on its ethical directives from God to be those of the government. That the key thing is, where do you draw the line? And I think where we draw the line, to some degree, is where even natural law shows that if you allow this to happen, then it would be most inappropriate, because the fabric of society can be affected. Now, we believe, teach, and confess that any time you do murder, regardless of what the laws of the land are, that is inappropriate. But we do not think murder is the simple killing of someone. You can kill someone and it not be murder. And there are many examples of that. For example, a soldier at war, or a policeman shooting at bank robbers who are shooting at him in the course of a robbery, or capital punishment. Now, let's use capital punishment. There are some folks who think that capital punishment is okay and others who don't. The Bible does permit capital punishment. Not only are there a lot of examples where God carries that out, but there's no doubt from Romans chapter 13, what does it say? He is God's minister to you for good. Rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. And verse 4 says, if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. So we have a situation here where, from a biblical point of view, capital punishment is okay. Can you ever think of a Christian politician who would vote, therefore, against capital punishment? And the answer is yes. Because according to the Bible, capital punishment must be done in a way that is just. That is to say, just because you are a wealthy person should not give you an advantage in beating a crime that deserves capital punishment than if you were a poor person. In fact, many of us will remember some years ago, the Supreme Court basically struck down most of the laws dealing with capital punishment. And why did they do that? They did that because the way the laws were set up, there was an undue advantage towards certain classes of people, such as the wealthy, or certain races, white versus black. And so it's not that the Supreme Court said you cannot do capital punishment. No, they backed off it and said it needs to be done in a way that is as fair and just as possible. And so states went about the business of redoing their laws on capital punishment so they were appropriate. For example, there's a principle in the Bible, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That is really not a revenge code, although some people have turned it into that. It is really a very fair and just code. What it means is this. Let's say that you are a peasant and you have a pet cow or a pet lamb, and you are living on a farm working for the master. And the master decides that he's hungry one day, and so he comes and he kills your pet lamb and uses that to feed his friends. Is that appropriate? No, that would be actual stealing. But in many societies, the master of the farm would have sway to do something like that, and nothing would happen to him. Whereas if the peasant, let's say he went and stole a chicken from the master, the peasant could be put to death. See, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was actually a very fair way of saying whether you're wealthy or rich, you ought to get the same punishment. And it ought to fit the crime. It ought not be greater than the crime. Well, one of the laws that legislators wrote some time ago was after the death of Lindbergh's baby. Lindbergh, the fellow who flew across the Atlantic, I think his plane is over here at Lindbergh, the airport. His son had been kidnapped and in the process had been put to death. So a law was put on the books that anyone who kidnapped an individual deserved the death penalty. Well, that was a not smart law. Why? Because if you were a kidnapper and kidnapped somebody and then you got the money, there was no reason you would keep those people alive. Well, why leave a witness? And so you would put them to death because there was no punishment for putting them to death more than you were already getting for kidnapping them. And thankfully, that law was changed very quickly when people came to realize that that was an inappropriate law, namely such a law that would do what was said in that circumstance. So the crime needs to fit the punishment. I would think that a Christian, therefore, in regard to capital punishment, could be against okaying capital punishment in certain situations where it is unfair to certain people or because it has been used in a way to get rid of certain classes of people. And so even though you would support capital punishment, you wouldn't want to impose your religious belief on someone if it is done in a way that is inappropriate. I'm still of the opinion, though, that when it comes to abortion, when it comes to marriage of homosexuals, that the Christian politician cannot support laws that would authorize that. But the bigger question is, can we then vote for such a politician? If a politician is in support of, let's say, abortion. Now, this may surprise you, but I think there are circumstances where you could vote for such a politician. And we'll talk about that when we get back from the break. In the meantime, our numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address at lawgospel@kfuo.org. You're listening to Law and Gospel. I'm Tom Baker on this Thursday, October 11th. Stay with us through the break.
At AM 850 KFUO, October is a special month. The last day of October marks the anniversary of the 16th century Reformation. Perhaps there's a day in October that's special to you. Consider becoming an AM 850 KFUO day sponsor. We have several days in our October calendar still open for your day sponsorship. To find out what it means to become an AM 850 KFUO day sponsor, go to our website, kfuo.org, or contact Chuck Rathard at 314-505-7831.
Underwriting on AM 850 KFUO provided by Reliable Heating and Cooling. Christian people who understand the value of bringing you God's Word on the radio. The folks at Reliable also know how important it is to have your furnace checked before winter. An inefficient or deteriorating heat exchanger costs you needless expense and could be dangerous. A preseason inspection from Reliable is convenient, affordable, and gives you peace of mind. Reliable Heating and Cooling, supporting the broadcast ministry of AM 850 KFUO.
Hi, this is Dr. Bill Meyer with the James Dobson Family Minute. Kids are inevitably going to disobey, but it's important for parents to separate willful disobedience from childish mistakes. Here's my colleague Dr. James Dobson to explain.
The child looks you in the eye, and he analyzes the possibilities, and like a little military general, he calculates the potential risks, and he marshals his forces and attacks you. See, that kind of behavior must be met by firm authority and leadership on the part of the parent. But it is very different from spilling milk and making mistakes and just being childish and irresponsible.
When you're defiantly challenged by a child, win decisively. When your child asks, "Who's in charge?" tell him. When his actions are asking, "Who loves me?" take him in your arms and surround him with affection. And when he makes a childish mistake, don't make a big deal out of it. For more on raising a healthy, happy kid, go to FocusOnYourChild.com.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. God's Word tells us to sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence. Join us next time as we help individuals learn to discern truth from error in today's world.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 850 KFUO.
What do we mean by the term Jesus' state of humiliation? Here's how Pastor Scott Seidler explained it recently on the Bible study.
Jesus Christ, though God, humbled himself and became obedient to the very things that God ought not be obedient to. The giver of life became obedient to death. The creator became submissive and gave his life at the hands of creatures. The one who provides manna from heaven, he felt hunger. The one who provides water from the rock, he felt thirst. The one who created community at the very beginning in the garden by giving husband and wife to one another felt loneliness. The one who gives joy cried and wept at the death of Lazarus. All of those experiences that Christ went through were experiences that the creator of heaven and earth ought not to have experienced, and yet he did for the sake of your salvation, our salvation.
Listen to the Bible study weekday mornings at 10:05.
Hi, I'm Pastor Doug Nicely. This Sunday we're going to listen to a very familiar story from the Gospels, the story of the 10 lepers who came to visit Jesus and asked for them to be healed, and that there were 9 who were cleansed, but only one, a Samaritan, who came and gave thanks. We're going to talk about who gets a second chance this week on In His Steps.
Listen to In His Steps Saturday at noon with Pastor Doug Nicely on AM 850 KFUO.
We're talking about whether Christians, as politicians or working in the civil realm, can hold to a position contrary to their personal beliefs. And I think we've given enough examples in the first part of the hour to show that that is true. I have a personal belief that sins of thought and word are as bad as sins of deeds, but I'm not going to impose that on the government in the sense that if somebody is caught using the name of God in vain, that they should have a fine or be put in jail. I just don't think that that's going to work in this country right now. So there's a lot of areas where we allow no-fault divorce, which we wouldn't allow in the church. However, in areas where the morality of the scripture impinges on the society itself, where things are going to start going downhill, particularly in the murder of innocent individuals, such as abortion, or in marriage of homosexuality, which will tremendously have an effect on the family in a society, then those kinds of areas, I think, are pretty obvious that you need to stand with what you believe and don't use the idea that you can't impose your beliefs on others. For example, the idea, the argument that respect for the sanctity of innocent life constitutes a purely religious conviction with no place in public policy would indeed surprise the authors of the Declaration of Independence, which, by the way, describes the right to life as unalienable and self-evident. And then those politicians who, boy, really are reluctant to impose their personal beliefs with regard to abortion, they hardly show such reticence on other issues. They're really ready to impose their beliefs on us in the raising of taxes or certain freedoms that we would lose that also may be part of their religious beliefs. And the other idea is that Are not most of the laws in the land of a religious nature? For example, thou shalt not murder is also part of someone's religion. Just because you can support that law, thou shalt not murder, even though you're an atheist, doesn't mean that that doesn't come from a religious sensibility. There are certain rules of natural law that just seems inappropriate for behavior to occur. And it would seem to me that homosexuality, abortion, these kinds of things are correct. For example, in my religion, it's not inappropriate to drink liquor. Does that mean, therefore, that I should not support any time somebody gets liquored up and is drunk and has a car accident and causes damage? No. Because even though something may be permitted, there's certain rules to be followed that if you go to excess and it causes damage to others or other property, then you need to be held accountable. So we don't have a problem with allowing you to drink, but we do have a problem with allowing a person to drink and then drive. Now, in the area of drugs, it's kind of interesting that some people want to put that in the same category of liquor, that people should be able to take all the drugs they want as long as they don't hurt or harm someone else. The problem there, though, is, as has been shown historically, once drugs also become available to people, then they kind of lose their inhibitions, they lose their ability to think, and yes, to some degree like liquor, but even more so causes other problems, a real division of the family. So society can make choices. For example, right now in certain states, you're allowed to take marijuana, to smoke marijuana, if it is for certain health issues. And they're already finding out that they got a real problem in permitting that sometimes because of the things that are happening in those areas. What we're coming down to is this, is because we are Christians, that doesn't mean that we can impose our ethics on a society in all situations. And I've already named a few that we cannot impose. In fact, one of the most important to me is the baptism of infants. Can you imagine having a law in the United States of America that within 1 week after your child is born, you need to have it baptized, need to have him or her baptized? Well, that would be inappropriate. Because religious belief is not something you can legislate, only morality and ethics. And even though a lot of morality and ethics flows out of religious belief, there is a sharp dichotomy between values and ethics that are obvious to just most people, in contrast that are part of a specific religious point of view. But now let me get to the question that I spoke about just prior to the break. So you have somebody who has a pro-abortion position. Would you ever vote for him? Well, it depends. You see, what we're faced with in the United States of America, even though an independent party is trying to get on its feet, and it occurs every now and then, it appears that the Democrat or the Republican will be the president next of the United States. So going with an independent party doesn't make too much sense in light of the fact that you're probably not going to ever get one of those individuals to be the president. Now let's take the issue of abortion. Abortion has a lot of ramifications to it when somebody is thinking about it or talking about it. For instance, there are a lot of people who might agree with the right to abort, but are really quite opposed to partial abortion, where a child is partially born and then put to death. Now, if you had two individuals, and regardless of party affiliation, one is, they're both for abortion in the sense of a common right, they think, and they don't want to impose their morality on someone. But on the other hand, one is for partial abortion and the other one isn't. It seems to me, therefore, that rather than not vote at all, you would support at least the one who is against partial abortion. Because then steps could be taken, if that person was elected, to stop some of the more lurid and murderous parts of the abortion process, ones that are really cruel, even from a human point of view. Although from God's point of view, we need to recognize that any abortion that's elective is inappropriate and wrong and sinful. You could also have this. Let's say you have two people who are for abortion. They're the only candidates you can vote on. And the one says that when it comes to the Supreme Court, he is going to put on there people who need to keep updating the Constitution and change it. Whereas the other one says, no, I'm a strict constructionist and the Constitution needs to be interpreted as it was meant to be. Well, in that case, you have a lot better odds of having a Supreme Court justice who would shoot down the abortion laws simply because they make no sense whatsoever. Just read any history and how they came about. They were done on faulty evidence, and there is really no right in the Constitution for a woman to kill a baby. I mean, where do we find that in the Constitution? So here's your choice. You would vote for someone who is both for partial birth abortion and is going to choose Supreme Court justices who are going to advance the cause of abortion. Or you have a pro-choice candidate who is against partial birth abortion and he is going to advance the cause in a Supreme Court of somebody who strictly interprets the Constitution the way it was meant to be. It seems to me in that category, I would prefer to vote for somebody who has 2 points in the right direction rather than none. But that, again, is a thing of conscience. As some people say, no, I got to stick on principle. Well, that's not biblical principle. That's just your personal principle. Remember, Jesus gave taxes to Caesar, a person who was not at all enamored with Jesus as being the Christ. The head of the Roman Empire, therefore, received taxes, and Jesus says that was appropriate to do so, even though the Jews were under Roman occupation. In fact, that's the reason that some of the smart lawyers and Pharisees came to Jesus trying to trick him and say, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? If he said, yes, you should, then the people would turn against Jesus because they hate the Roman occupation. If he said, no, you shouldn't, they could rush to Pontius Pilate and say, here's a guy who's creating insurrection. What are you going to do about it? Either way, they thought they had Jesus in the grasp of their paws, when in reality, he came back to them and said, well, whose picture is on the coin? And they said, well, you know, it's the Roman, Caesar. Well, give unto Caesar what is Caesar, and give unto God what is God. It doesn't really matter, according to Romans 13, when it says to pay taxes to whom taxes are due, whether the government officials are Lutheran, Christian, Mormon, Muslim, or atheist. Their task is not to impose their personal religious beliefs insofar as they are not part of the morality of a good society on anybody. That's why it doesn't really bother me to hear things from the President of the United States that I don't agree with. Now, obviously, in the previous president, he had certain definitions about what was sexual behavior that I think any common-thinking person would disagree with. And this present president, President Bush, has the idea that we're all worshiping the same God. He just comes in different forms, which I think any person who reads the Bible will recognize that Jesus is the only way, the truth, and the life. And to say that particularly Muslims are worshiping the true God is really contrary to the Holy Scripture. And in case you're wondering about that, all you have to do is go ask a Muslim, or ask a Mormon, or ask a Jew if they're worshiping the God you worship. And they're going to come right out and say, no, we're not. Yours is a false god. I just had a friend indicate to me that there's a speech out by a Elder Mormon recently where he just really contradicts what Christians believe today. And we're getting a hold of that, and we may have a segment on law and gospel, taking a look at that in the whole. If you like to phone in, our numbers here are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is lawgospel@kfuo.org. That's lawgospel@kfuo.org. What we're trying to do from a law gospel perspective is the law is pretty clear as to what the will of God is. But in the area of politics, as God himself pointed out, sometimes you have to allow divorce for the hardness of their heart. And so sometimes you allow certain things that you wouldn't personally do. Like you allow swearing, you allow cursing, you allow other things that would be contrary to the word of God. But you cannot legislate Christianity. That is, you cannot make laws so that everybody becomes a Christian. Because just doing the Christian things or not doing the Christian sins in no way makes you a Christian. You can probably become a pretty good person and then go to hell as a good person rather than as a criminal. But whether you're a criminal or whether you're just a good person, it has no impact at all as to whether you're going to heaven or hell. So when we're talking about morality, especially in the political realm, we're really talking about not so much thoughts and words, but the external obedience to certain commands. And therefore, one needs to think of this in a way from a political sense where compromise is the art of doing business. Take a very simple example. You're in a suburb, and there's a lot of children in the suburb. And it would be wonderful if on every corner there was a light, a red, orange, green light, stop lights. And it would be wonderful because there would be very few accidents because you'd only go through when it's green and stop when it's red. The cost would be tremendous, though, to put that on every corner in the subdivision. And so, therefore, some corners you only have a stop sign or maybe even a yield sign. Or you have nothing at all. I just drive around any big city like St. Louis, and you'll find numerous corners that as you come up to, there's neither a yield on any of the four corners, a stop sign, there's nothing. But there's a kind of a written rule, or unwritten rule as one might have it, where the person on the right has the right of way. And so there are some items understood there. So if you go through that and hit somebody, you're still held liable, even though there was no stop sign or yield sign. There's just certain rules of the road that need to be kept in mind there. So also, when we're dealing with politics on the grand scheme of things, we've always said it's the art of compromise for a very simple reason. Think of a large pie. We'll think of a lemon pie. And it's one of these 12-inchers. Or if you're going down the highway, you see these advertisements, foot-high pies. I've often thought about stopping in there to see if it really is a foot high. It must be a lot of whipped cream on top or something. I don't know how they make it a foot high. Or maybe they have it sideways or something. Who knows? At any rate, these foot-high pies, therefore, are something that you could probably purchase without any problem, but are they really a foot? You can measure it. See, no, it's not quite a foot, so I'm not quite sure whether I'm going to, get that. In the area of law, there are certain things that you need to do to accuracy, but it's not necessary to follow them all according to your religion. You can have a lot of religious point of views that aren't necessary to be imposed upon a state. That just wouldn't be appropriate. But where it has a great effect on the state, where the community can be sorely hurt, then you need to put those laws in place. In a sense, honor your father and mother. If you take a look at that fourth commandment, we'll recognize that father means much more than your paternal parent. It also can be your adopted parent. Or it can also be the pastor is considered a father in the church, or it can be also a government official. So if a policeman pulls me over, it is my duty to pull over and stop. And then if he tells me I need to get out of the area because they've got a roadblock up ahead and we can't go through that way, then you listen to the policeman and you obey him as if it were God himself. Now that's why punishment for policemen who use their authority wrongly should be very, very severe. Because we're told, and God tells us, that we are to obey officials in authority. It's something that I think is important to keep in mind. If you'd like to call me on any of these items, the numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Now, I do agree with Archbishop Burke, who suggests that such people who disagree by voting on something that is an extreme moral policy should not be communed in the church. I think that's absolutely appropriate, because where it is clear as glass that this is the law of God for both the church and the government, and you still refuse to do it, such as the protection of children so they're not murdered in abortion, then you should be held accountable for that, and one of the losses you will suffer is receiving the Lord's Supper. Let's go to the phone lines right now, and we'll begin by talking to James. Hi, James.
Hello, Pastor. In a pluralistic system, and maybe you'll get a chance to kind of hash that out, I don't know if you'll be talking about it a little more in the next hour, but if the candidates emerge from the popular culture in a pluralistic system, should we Christians not choose from the lesser of two evils, or should we abstain? And if we abstain, then are we at the mercy of the popular culture because we didn't participate, kind of like passive participants in what's going on?
Well, stay on the line. If, for instance, I had a choice between Hitler and Mussolini, then I would abstain, because both of them would be very detrimental to the government, as we saw with either Nazism or fascism. However, if it's a choice between people like in the United States, where the president has such a powerful influence on the choice of Supreme Court justices, and you have one of them who says, regardless of their position on abortion, that they're going to appoint a strict constructionist on the Supreme Court rather than somebody who's going to open up the floodgates even more, I think it would be inappropriate not to vote for the individual who's at least promised to put someone on the Supreme Court that will advance our position, even though his personal position is something with which we disagree. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, but in a pluralistic system, it usually produces candidates out of a popular culture, and we don't seem to have those type of individuals coming out that would want a lobbyist or what you would call a legislative type of judge to be on the Supreme Court. We'll be subject to whatever our popular culture is producing these days. And if we as Christians don't participate, we kind of leave ourselves to the mercy of that.
Well, wouldn't you agree, though, that the last two Supreme Court justices were not on the basis of popular culture, but do have some pretty strong convictions and principles in strict constructionism, and they've already started moving back on some of the pro-abortion laws?
Yes, that's what I mean, that at that time, the popular culture was conducive to that, but it seems to be moving.
That was 2 years ago.
Yeah, it seems to be moving now, Pastor. And,
I don't think so.
Oh, you don't think so?
No, I don't think that the culture has moved that much. If anything, it's almost getting back. For example, even in religious circles, a couple of days ago, I don't know if you heard me, we were talking about the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. Mm-hmm. Because of their moves toward popular culture in such a way where they're now encouraging the ordination of homosexuals, more and more of their young theologians are coming out against that position and trying to move the church back into a more of a biblical position.
Yes.
So there's a pendulum.
There is.
And I don't know. I don't think the pendulum is swinging more towards the popular culture kind of thing. And it really doesn't matter much what the popular culture thinks if the Congress is going to still put into office Supreme Court justices that are strict constructionists. I think that's where the key is.
That's true. We do have a little bit more, I believe, control over the Congress, but if you're talking about the pluralistic system in our democracy, which is an irony that we only have two candidates in a democracy that would be viable, it seems that, as I was listening to it, even though some of them are pro-choice, the plank of their particular party doesn't support them, but they are pro-choice because the popular culture would, and they would think that they can win because of that. But I would hang up and listen, and hopefully you can explain a little more about pluralism.
Yes. There we get into motivation on people as to whether or not they're of a particular position because they need more votes. For instance, in this article, it was talking about New York former Mayor Giuliani. If he really wanted to be elected as a Republican, then he would come out and say, well, I've changed my mind, and I'm no longer against abortion. But he's not doing that. So I think there's something else going on in his mind that I can't understand. But there is a principle he's trying to follow, over which he is in error, it appears to me. But depending on his opponent, if that person also is going to be pro-choice, then you really need to look at their entire record as well as their promises to see what area you're going to get into. Now, I know one of the problems is how many politicians were pro-life, and that's how they got elected, and then once they got into position, they changed and went pro-death. That's happened a number of times, and you can count on one hand, like Governor Romney, who'd gone the other way, where they were pro-death and now have become pro-life. And that's probably because more of his Mormon roots than just simply trying to get a lot of votes. Because anytime a politician changes, that's almost detrimental to his common understanding that here's a guy who's going to change with the wind, depending on whatever. But as you can see, it's a bigger problem and a bigger situation than any pastor can get in the pulpit and say, okay, here's where you need to vote for. That would be entirely inappropriate. Christian laity have just as much common sense as a pastor does in this area, as long as they keep in mind some of the principles from the Scripture, as well as being guided in some way, so they attempt to do the will of God as best as they are able. In the second hour, we're going to leave this conversation and move into a number of emails that we received that we really need to start responding to. And, of course, remember, tomorrow is Open Line Friday, where you can talk on anything to your heart's content. I'm Tom Baker. Thanks for listening to the first hour. Stay tuned for the second.
Listen to Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, Monday through Friday at 1:05 p.m. on AM 850 KFUO. You can write Pastor Tom at AM 850 KFUO, 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. Or at this email address, lawgospel@lawgospel.com.